Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, Episode 5.1, Taking Stock. This podcast is broken into seasons. These are moments in time where, for the sake of keeping things organized, I draw lines to help separate one period from another. These lines are nothing more than delineation points that historians, and in this case me, use as a tool to help craft a better narrative. The fact, however, is that history is not something that is divided by these lines. Following the Battle of Yorktown, it was not as though anybody woke up the next day aware of just how profoundly everything had just changed. They knew it was a major blow to the British, to be sure. However, Washington was quickly back at work, planning campaigns to continue the war. It was only through hindsight that it became clear in time that we can see these larger changes. I bring this up as we move into the fifth season because, really, little has changed from where I left off last season. Where we are picking up the story, the war has yet to even officially end. However, as we know, following Yorktown, things had changed. Despite some final attempts to save the empire, it was increasingly clear to everybody that the British would not be retaining the majority of their former North American colonies outside of Canada. This season is about that critical question that the new United States was now going to have to answer in the aftermath of Yorktown that would often prove to be so vexing. The question of, now what? The war was ending, though again not actually over just yet. The United States seemingly had won. Now they were going to have to figure out exactly what winning the revolution meant. Winning the war was one thing. Having to govern a country was an entirely different matter. That is what this season of the podcast is going to be about. That journey from the end of the American Revolution through the growing pains of the early republic, as the new nation begins to figure out not only how to stand on its own, but where it fits into the greater geopolitical picture. We are going to pick up where we left off, with the end of Britain's prosecution of the war in North America. We will then move all the way to the election of 1828, when the election of Andrew Jackson will once again provide us with another one of those delineating lines. This week, I want to spend our time by doing a bit of a survey of just where everything stood heading into the spring of 1782. The British ministry had, somewhat reluctantly, admitted that the war in North America was a lost cause, and that they were going to cease prosecuting it. However, exactly what that meant was not yet clear. The British were still fighting the French and the Spanish, as everybody still had strategic aims that they wished to achieve before the outbreak of peace. This means that, for the United States, they entered into a rather tenuous situation. They were still at war with the British, and indeed, fighting would continue into 1782, though, as we are going to discuss today, it took on a much different look. Nobody knew what the final peace was going to look like, or even exactly what the Americans had won. At the same time, peace would usher in a whole new slew of problems and crises that would help define the American experience, not just in the 1780s, but for the entire history of the nation. The young United States was broke. Like, profoundly, profoundly broke. Recall Trench Tillman asking Congress to cover his travel expenses, and the delegates having to dig into their pockets to chip in a few bucks here and there in order to reimburse him. It is not exactly a sign of a robust economy when the government has to crowdsource such a trivial amount. Now, if you have been following along, this is not exactly news to you. The country had been broke for a while. During the war, French grants and loans had largely floated the government. However, the longer the war went on, the more those sources dried up. By 1782, the well truly was becoming dry. These economic issues had led to some of the darkest days of the war in early 1781, when the army was rocked with multiple mutinies. This did, however, have the effect of forcing the Congress to act. The Continental Congress had come together and unanimously passed the Declaration of Independence back in 1776, And while that grand moment remains a much-heralded moment in American history, it also marks just about the only time that there was unanimity in Congress. Congress functioned largely through the use of endless committees that were often slow to react and inefficient at dealing with the problems of the day. There was absolutely nothing about this form of government that had the slightest trappings of an executive branch. The problem is that following the mutinies of early 1781, Congress found itself in a precarious position. The committee system avoided placing too much power in any single individual, which in the middle of a war over the power of the monarch, well, that makes sense that the delegates would be skittish to such things. However, those mutinies had illustrated the difficulty of ruling via committee and showed the real risks posed by the rampant inefficiency and ineffectiveness of the Congress. In early 1781, a shaken Congress read the room and moved to appoint individual executives in certain critical departments, where rule by committee was simply not compatible with good governance. These departments included the Department of War, Marine, Foreign Affairs, and, critically, the Treasury. Ironically, the choice for the first minister was virtually unanimous, as the wealthy merchant Robert Morris was installed. Now, if you are paying close attention, the election of Morris might on the surface seem like an odd choice. If we go back to 1776 and the debates on the Declaration of Independence, Robert Morris stood firm with John Dickinson in opposition. In fact, when the vote came, Morris had joined Dickinson in skipping the vote altogether, which was enough to swing the Pennsylvania delegation in the direction of voting for independence. Morris did, unlike Dickinson, come around when it came time to put ink to paper, and he did sign the declaration, despite never actually voting in favor of it. This might leave you wondering just how somebody like Morris would find himself so politically rehabilitated that he could find himself being chosen for this all-important office. By 1781, a new movement was beginning to gain meaningful power in Congress. This group, which has become known to history as the Nationalists, had been around for a while and were largely comprised of those more moderate delegates in the Congress. These men tended to be more grounded in their approach and would be made up mostly of men like our old friend John Dickinson, John Jay, Gouverneur Morris, James Madison, and Robert Morris. What the Nationalists were in favor of was a more powerful central government, and rejecting the idea that the states ultimately contained all the sovereignty. Now, I don't want to mislead you all into believing that the Nationalists were some kind of cohesive political party, akin to a modern-day Republican or Democrat party, or even the much more contemporary Federalists. Neither in 1781 nor today should they be in any way considered to be an actual political party. They were more of a loosely connected group that had generally the same broad end goals for the government. Actual political parties were still several years away. This movement provided an opportunity for men like Morris and Dickinson to rehabilitate themselves following their low ebb that came in the wake of the debates over the Declaration of Independence. Where this group found a path towards political relevance is that they proved to be capable administrators during a war, where the more ideally minded Congress proved to be wildly inefficient at making even the most simple of decisions. This brings us back full circle to the beginning of 1781, with the Continental Army at very real risk of disintegration. With Congress finding itself cornered and the committee system unable to meet the demands that were being placed upon it, there was little choice but to shift powers to individual administrators. The Nationalists, who supported and advocated this exact thing, were there, ready to step right on in to that newly opened void. Morris was the most powerful merchant in the new nation, and had the connections and sway to get things done, yet at the same time he often felt overwhelmed by the task at hand. Now, as an interesting aside, looking for some helpful advice, shortly after he took office, he wrote to his French counterpart, Jacques Necker. Unfortunately for Morris, Necker was no longer in the role, having been booted from it by the time that Morris was sending his letter across the Atlantic. Now, if you know anything about the storm clouds gathering over France during the early 1780s, You are aware that the firing of Necker was not a popular decision amongst the French population. However, that is a story for another podcast. As we have already discussed, although Maurice was taking a job as the leader of the treasury, that was not exactly a great position to be in when said treasury contained no money. When, at the end of May, Washington rode desperately in need of flour to feed the army, there simply were no funds which to procure the needed flour. The solution Congress came up with was just granting Washington permission to seize whatever he needed. The army needed to survive, and if that meant just taking what they needed and dealing with the fallout later, well, then so be it. Maurice, however, found this position anathema to everything that he believed in. With no money to cover the order, Maurice went ahead and placed his own personal credit on the line. Credit which was far better than that of the United States at the time, in order to make the required purchase. Although Maurice would occasionally lend his own name and credit to help boost the nation, he was well aware that this was a very temporary measure at best, and certainly was not a solution to the money problems faced by the United States. The pet project of Maurice, therefore, became the creation of a national bank. Maurice firmly believed that the entire point of the revolution was the protection of property. This should not exactly be a revelation either. Had not the entire imperial crisis been centered around the question of the British government taking American property? The resistance from the Americans was always against the taking of their property without their consent via the use of taxation. Per historian Richard Middlecuff, it was this fear of the states returning to their old haphazard ways of dealing with finance that really worried men like Maurice. What he wanted was a centralized system of banking, something far more streamlined and centralized than the states running a variety of pell-mell systems. A national bank would help to normalize that system and would provide a way that the United States could begin the arduous process of establishing a system of credit. A bank could help fund war debts, a topic that we are going to be returning to in the coming episodes. It likewise could extend loans, which, as again they were a function of the bank's lending ability, exceeded the amount of capital the bank actually had on hand. A bank issuing its own banknotes would be able to begin to get control over the serious shortage of specie in the colonies and the huge amounts of low-value paper currency that was actively circulating in the economy. Robert Maurice and Gouverneur Maurice, who were not related by the way, were busy working on the details of the new bank even before Robert Maurice had officially accepted the job. The plan was to fund the bank with $400,000 in initial capital, sold in shares of $400 apiece. Those who invested would receive a single vote for the board of the bank and were told to anticipate an annual dividend at around 6%. The bank was not going to be an official part of the government. Rather, it was going to be a private entity that would work directly with Congress. The bank would likewise provide for private loans, which was meant to be the backbone of this entire endeavor. Most critically, this is going to have a major effect on the value of the currency. The banknotes being offered by this bank would have their value set by the public confidence that existed in the bank and not through the central government. Should the public show high confidence in the bank, and as a consequence the banknotes be in high demand, their value would rise as a function of that. On the other hand, if there was low confidence in the bank and nobody paid any attention to the banknotes, their value would subsequently drop. This was a radical departure from anything that the United States had done during its colonial history, when banks were not something that meaningfully existed within the country. Now, credit was going to become such a major backbone of restoring the finances of the nation. Such a radical decision was not met with universal praise either. James Madison, for instance, worried that Congress lacked the ability to establish a bank under the Articles of Confederation. However, despite some pushback, Maurice was able to get enough states on board to push the bank through. With the bank now approved and Morris off to secure the necessary funding to get it established, I'm going to leave Morris and his nationalist friends here. We are going to have much more to say about the economy. And indeed, it is going to be a commonly reappearing topic over the next several episodes. However, for this week, I do have a few other topics that I want to cover in order to make sure that everybody is on the same page as we move forward through 1782. It is common that today we celebrate the Franco-American victory at Yorktown as being the end of the American Revolution. However, we already know that isn't exactly true. The victory at Yorktown marked the end of the British prosecution of the war in North America against their former colonies. Critically, however, that is really all it meant. Even as the North ministry was collapsing during the early spring, the British were still not making promises. Sure, there were plenty of people who saw the writing on the wall and fully understood that they would never be regaining their rebellious colonies. However, for others, the hope of reconciliation along the lines of the Carlisle Commission's plan from 1778 remained the goal. It likewise would not even be fair to say that the victory at Yorktown ended fighting in the war. You might have noticed that I am always very specific when I say that it ends the war in North America. Yes, the British were done pressing the issue against their, now likely former colonists. But a war that had started as a civil war had evolved into a global conflict. The British were still engaged against both the French and the Spanish in the greater overall war. Recall that following the victory at Yorktown, neither Washington nor Lafayette could convince Admiral de Grasse to head down to Charleston and liberate the city from British control. De Grasse had his orders, and those were to get back down to the more valuable targets in the Caribbean. The French were feeling pretty good about themselves heading into 1782. The French Navy had scored a major victory against their British counterparts in the Chesapeake the previous fall, which consequently opened up the door for the eventual siege and victory in Yorktown. Everybody in the French court was feeling nice and confident in French naval power, and decided that this was the time to shoot their shot. Louis XVI ordered that de Grasse move against and capture Jamaica. The capture of Jamaica would have been a huge blow to the British, both in terms of their national pride as well as financially. Historian Woody Holton refers to the island as the crown jewel of the British Caribbean. It really was that valuable of a holding. On April 12, 1782, de Grasse, along with 30 ships, was on his way to link up with the Spanish Navy for a strike on Jamaica. Near a small series of islands, known as the Saints, the British Navy, under George Rodney, caught up with the French. The Battle of the Saints began as naval battles of the era did. The two navies maneuvered around each other until they were in position to launch a broadside. From the very beginning, it was rough going for the French. De Grasse quickly ran into trouble when confusion broke out amongst the ships and exactly where they were supposed to be going. The ensuing disorder timed up nicely with a change in the wind. With the French now exposed and disorganized, Rodney would seize the opportunity. Firing on de Grasse's ships from both sides, Rodney was able to divide the French fleet into three main parts, which he then was able to methodically attack. As the smoke cleared, the French had suffered a devastating loss at the hands of the British. 5,000 Frenchmen were captured. Several thousand more were dead. The British had managed to capture a stunning 5 French ships of the line, including the French flagship. De Grasse himself was captured and taken into British custody. The French loss at the Battle of the Saints was every bit as devastating as the British losses in Yorktown and Saratoga had been. The French would never again challenge the British for naval supremacy in the war. The British holdings in the Caribbean were secure from French incursion. Likewise, as peace talks picked up, this defeat would help pour some cold water on French plans for the peace negotiations. Even before the Battle of the Saints, the French really needed this war to come to an end. Recall earlier today that I had mentioned the ousting of Jacques Necker. A big reason that Necker was now out of a job is because the French had spent a whole lot of money on the war, and they were now hurtling towards their own financial catastrophe. If that was not enough to convince Louis XVI that it was time for peace, a devastating and humiliating naval loss surely would do the trick. Any lofty ambitions for the peace that the French might have harbored? Well, they were now increasingly finding themselves with their own backs up against the wall, in a war that they needed to be over. The Battle of the Saints had very little to do with the question of American independence. The United States was not even involved in the battle. If Washington had had his way, de Grasse would have never even been in the Caribbean to begin with. This all really goes to show just how much the war had expanded. That the biggest French loss of the war came after Yorktown is also important, as it clearly shows that the war was not yet over. Even within the United States, Yorktown did not mark the end of the war, but rather it marked the end of the British pushing the issue. The British, however, remained solidly entrenched at several critical locations, including New York. While no major battles took place inside the United States during 1782, the British were also not yet withdrawing or giving up anything that they had. Had Washington gotten the idea that he should cross the Hudson and make an attempt to retake New York, do not doubt for an instant that the British would have had any qualms whatsoever at violently repulsing the Americans, and, if at all possible, destroying Washington's army. For the new British commander, our old friend from Canada, Guy Carleton, the orders were to simply stand pat. Even if the British and the Americans were going to spend much of the year eyeing each other nervously, that also did not mean that 1782 was a completely peaceful year in North America. In fact, the situation in the Ohio country was quickly becoming much worse. The situation began with the British allied Wyandots, booting some Moravian Delaware Indians off their land in the eastern Ohio Valley. Unable to really resist, the Delaware caved and abandoned several villages. One of these villages, and I apologize for probably butchering the pronunciation, was Gnadenhutten, which keep that name in mind because we're going to be returning here in just a few moments. These villages were largely located in what today is the central part of the state of Ohio. For instance, the aforementioned Gnadenhutten was located about halfway in between modern-day Columbus and Pittsburgh. The interest in these locations for the Wyandots is that they provided a great position in which to launch attacks against Americans living along the Pennsylvania frontier. The Wyandots had been the source of much suffering along the frontier, and throughout 1781, they were busy making life difficult for those living in the area. During the winter of 1782, some of these previously evicted Delaware were able to return to the lands that had been taken by the Wyandots. Most of these people returning were there doing what just about anybody would in the situation. They wanted to pick up the pieces of their broken lives and salvage whatever they could. The problem here, per historian Robert Parkinson, is that the Americans living along the frontier misunderstood exactly what was happening here. It seems that they did not view the Delaware's return as being an inconsequential move. They believed at this point the Delaware had cut a deal with the enemy Wyandots, and that they were now busy harboring them amongst their ranks. The Moravian Delaware had long been an ally of the American frontiersmen, so this was seen as being nothing short of a complete betrayal and high-level treachery. In February 1782, with those living in western Pennsylvania already seething about the perceived betrayal of the Delaware, a Wyandot raid would cause the death of a settler's wife and three of his children. This was too much for those living along the frontier to handle. Western Pennsylvania is an area that has never been too shy about taking matters into their own hands. They were certainly not strangers to vigilantism. Recall the Paxton Boys, who very nearly chased the Pennsylvania leadership out of Philadelphia while slaughtering several innocent Indian men, women, and children along the way. Later this season, we are going to see these same Western Pennsylvania settlers pose a serious threat to the Washington administration when they rise up over an excise tax on whiskey. Now, angry and upset over their ordeal in the war, and the attempt by the leadership to court the Delaware and establish friendly relations with them, only for the Delaware to turn around and betray them, the settlers had had enough. On March 7th, 200 militiamen under the command of David Williamson reached Gnadenhütten and Salem, two of the towns that the Moravians had re-inhabited. The villages were not defended, allowing Williamson to march into the towns completely unopposed. In both locations, everybody was rounded up, with the men taken to one location and the women and children to another. For the militia, they were busy debating what they saw as being the two viable options that they had. They could march the Indians to Fort Pitt and turn them over to the fort's commander, Daniel Broadhead. The problem with this plan is that they hated Broadhead with a passion. They blamed him for trying to befriend the Delaware, and look how that had turned out for them. Unsurprisingly, therefore, many had no interest in taking the now captured Indians to Broadhead. This, unfortunately, left them with the second, far more grisly option. Kill them all. The next morning, the militia beat more than 90 people, men, women, and children, to death. They proceeded to scalp them, loot the villages, and burn everything to the ground. Although one would think that this massacre would be wildly unpopular, the narrative that would form in its aftermath tended to focus more on the Indian attacks along the western Pennsylvania frontier. The attack was more often than not framed in the light of self-defense, rather than the murder of innocent Indians. Going back to Robert Parkinson here, he points out that there was astonishingly little said about the massacre in Congress. An investigation was ordered, but nobody really ever followed up on it or really dug that deeply. Even if people were horrified by the acts, what was the solution? While they could agree that such a massacre was a problem, those same men out along the frontier provided the only defense that existed along the frontier from those British allied tribes. The real problem for the Americans during those spring months of 1782 is that, perhaps as much as ever, they needed the country to remain united. They needed some kind of a narrative that bound everybody together as a single entity. Realistically, even if congressional delegates were rightfully horrified at what had happened at Gnadenhütten, they lacked the ability to do much about it without risking a greater fracturing of that unity. Parkinson points out that during this same time it was Benjamin Franklin in France who would publish a story of the atrocities of the British allied native tribes that would become widely republished. In these reports, Franklin makes the claim that the Americans had recovered some 750 scalps that were being shipped by these allied tribes back to England. There was even a letter from a Seneca chief bragging about how good of a job that they had done destroying the enemy. The entire story was a complete fabrication. It was designed to help keep the Americans united against the British, especially now that the fighting was waning. This strategy was not fully without reason either. We have seen going back all the way to 1775 and the threats by Lord Dunmore to free the slaves, the power that such threats carried. Nothing united the states more than drawing into that common fear of slave insurrections and Indian attacks. John Burgoyne made those grand proclamations of recruiting the Indians to attack the frontiers as he marched through New York, something which did a very good job of making everybody hate his guts. Here we see Benjamin Franklin engaging in that same activity through his publishing of those blatant fabrications. This is not to say that Franklin approved of the vigilante actions by the militia at Gnadenhütten. He certainly did not. However, at the same time, he understood the power of the peace that he was running and decided to go with it. Now, it is important to note here that Franklin does not appear to have been aware of what had happened at Gnadenhütten prior to him making his publication. When he learned of the attack, however, his response was not to call out the settlers for their brutality, but rather was to point the finger at George III. He blamed the king for arming the Indians with hatchets and encouraging them to attack the frontiersmen. He admitted that maybe the settlers had gone too far in their attack, but that comes only after they had been made to stand through repeated acts of violence and attacks from these British allied tribes. Although certainly a poor take by Franklin, it is also interesting to note that nobody was mentioning the fact that the Moravians were not British allies and had not defected. Yet in this supercharged moment, that fact seemed to matter little to anybody involved. A massacre had taken place, and the only real thing that anybody seemed capable of doing about it was making sure that the correct spin was placed upon the story. Unsurprisingly, the one group that was absolutely not buying a word of the spin being applied was the Native Americans, who were rightfully horrified. Throughout the remainder of 1782, the war would largely be fought in the Ohio country, as Washington shifted more and more of his focus to neutralizing that theater of the war. Washington had actually replaced Broadhead at the same time that the massacre in Gnadenhütten was taking place. His replacement, William Crawford, would soon personally learn of the rage that the Ohio tribes felt following the massacre. Following a skirmish with a group of Shawnees, Crawford ordered a retreat. These retreating men were quickly overrun, and Crawford himself was soon captured. I'm going to spare you all the details because they really are that horrible. But suffice it to say that Crawford would, after a period of torture, die an absolutely awful death. Historian Gary Nash states in his book, The Unknown American Revolutionary, that the response of the states and of Congress in the wake of the attack on Gnadenhütten all but made the motto of the only good Indian is a dead Indian into an unofficial policy. At the end of the war, perhaps no group, with the possible exception of the slaves, lost more than the Indians. In the wake of Gnadenhütten, it was abundantly clear that the United States was disturbingly nonplussed by what had happened there. The British did little better at offering protection to those tribes that had allied with them. Again, turning to the work of Gary Nash here, the British reasoned that they were not abandoning their allies, but rather leaving them in the care of neighbors, who had it in their own best interest to establish harmonious relations with them. Of course, the British here are referring to the United States, who seemed presently uninterested in having a harmonious relationship with said Indians. As the spring of 1782 began, the United States found itself in a strange position. Following Yorktown, the British had decided to cease prosecuting the war in North America. Yet, the fighting continued. The French suffered their largest defeat of the conflict at the hands of the British. In the Ohio country, brutal fighting was taking place along the frontiers that included some of the worst atrocities of the entire war. At the same time, the government of the United States was flat broke, as the economy was in shambles after 7 years of war. The United States had, unofficially at this point, won the war against the British. However, that does not mean there was still not a whole lot of misery to go around. Next time, we are going to turn our attention back to the economic problems of the country, as Robert Morris desperately tries to keep the new nation afloat. Meanwhile, in Europe, peace negotiations would begin to bring about an official end to the war. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as we begin to officially bring the American War of Independence to a close.